First, Chris got to take off his commuting gloves and put on his pilot goggles, because if you're flying tomorrow, you might want to check with your airline. Major carriers are warning of potential flight cancellations and delays because the new 5G antennas being turned on by cell phone companies could interfere with the ability of airplanes to land in bad weather. So Chris explained this to us.
All right. The new C-band 5G frequencies that go active overnight are close to the frequencies used by the plane's radio altimeters. These altimeters use data from the ground to determine the plane's altitude on landing. The FAA and the major airlines are concerned that there could be interference from the new 5G system that could mess with those altimeters. They want the rollout of these new 5G frequencies delayed until more testing has been done. Alaska Airlines even sent me this statement from the president last night, quote, "Countless flights could be negatively impacted in some way, leaving passengers and flight crews stranded, angry, and frustrated. The consequences for our airline and all other U.S. carriers is incalculable, but this crisis is completely avoidable with tailored, temporary, and common sense delays." Now, I went to aviation insider Mike Stengel of Aerodynamic Advisory, and he doesn't expect this to be as big of an issue as the airlines are making it.
I don't think there's any threat to the flying public. I think the FAA is being very cautious in this rollout.
40 countries have already rolled out 5G and have seen no problems with interference with the radio altimeters. And Stengel says they're only used in rare occasions anyway.
The days where that is required are relatively infrequent. So these are days where, you know, the fog is pretty thick, or the cloud ceiling is below 200 feet and, you know, visibility less than a half a mile.
The radio altimeters that they're talking about here are engaged when the autopilot is being used to fly the plane all the way through landing. Most landings, of course, are done with a pilot at the controls. Even in bad weather, the pilot can disengage that autopilot at 200 feet and take over and complete the landing. And most large airports, including SeaTac, have restricted 5G zones to limit the potential interference.
There's a buffer zone around a number of the critical airports that have these low visibility approaches. And they can also play with the power levels of the 5G antennas so that there's even a greater, you know, safety buffer between the band that they're using and the band that's required for these aircraft instruments.
And once you peel back the layers, Dave, a little bit on this, a lot of the aviation insiders say this all really comes down to a fight between the FAA, which governs the airplanes, and the FCC, which governs the radio frequencies, with the public stuck in the middle over this fight. And they really don't believe that, I mean, this is as big of a deal as the airplane manufacturers and airlines are making it.
Well, I would actually prefer to go with the airlines on this one, because they're the ones who know about flying. So why would the... I mean, this implies that the FAA thinks the airlines are exaggerating, or what?
Well, they're concerned enough that there could... The thing is they it's always over potential interference, and they only have to be right once for this to go horribly wrong, right, as we've come to find out. And I talked in talking with the aviation insiders, a lot of them are thinking the FAA is being very, very cautious considering the way it handled MCAS on the MAX.
Yeah.
And they might not even be going this far had that not happened, because they don't want to be seen as approving something that ended up being catastrophic. So you're right. I mean, I'm not sure I want to fly a plane in low visibility with this until they figure it out, but it sounds like the rest of the world has this nailed down.
Well, but the way the rest of the world did it was to reduce the 5G power near the airports, right?
And we have that here.
We've already done that.
The problem is we don't have it at every airport, which is they have it at the major hubs, including SEA. But, you know, on some flights where they don't have it, you might get stuck in a place where there's low visibility and they don't have that a 5G dampener. So you could see that as well.
So these are we're talking in rural airports where the antenna near the airport is the only 5G available to the community or something like that?
Potentially something like that. So the airlines are saying basically the entire public is going to be grounded over this. Other people are saying, oh, it's not going to be that bad. So we'll see. But tomorrow's the day, and unless there's some sort of delay by the FCC in rolling these out.
Well, it sounds to me like the only problem would be that on a foggy day at a rural airport, somebody might not be able to get their video call through.
Exactly.
Right? It, just
right.
Turn it down.
Or at a faster speed. Exactly. If you want an error on the side of giving it to the airlines completely.
Right.
Totally.
In the state Senate, There was a virtual hearing on a series of gun bills, and 10,000 people signed in to either watch it or participate. So it sounds like a bunch of people think their guns are about to get grabbed. Let's go to Car News Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, there was definitely a lot of interest in this hearing yesterday. And obviously not everybody got a chance to have their say. I want to start, though, with this hearing. There were four bills heard in this hearing yesterday. A couple of them were from Republicans and didn't get quite the interest that the others did. But were interesting. The first one comes from Republican Senator Linda Wilson. And basically what this would do is increase penalties for people who are convicted of stealing guns from a house, a store, a business, something like that. Mm-hmm. Right now, the way our law is and the sentencing guidelines, people who steal firearms are only facing up to about a year in jail. She says that's not good enough.
I've heard from gun dealers or FFLs that criminals, many times already a felon, will brazenly go into their stores and steal firearms. They get a slap on the wrist and the crime is pleaded down or dismissed or not charged at all. We have focused our attention most recently on the good citizens that own those guns rather than where we focus. The focus should be is on the criminal. Let's increase the risk and the consequences of stealing that gun for that criminal.
So this bill would basically push that to a range of up to 5 years, I believe, for somebody who was convicted.
Well, that makes
that
sense.
Crime.
Does that have any support?
It does. It certainly has a lot of Republican support. But then you had some pushback from folks who testified. And this was kind of across the board. Any kind of new restrictions that we heard regarding gun laws yesterday. For the first time, I heard from the communities of color who came out and spoke out against these because they felt that they would disproportionately target specifically the black community. So that was the
really
opposition.
So Democrats were against upping the penalties for stealing guns.
So the lawmakers themselves do not weigh in on that bill
they
specifically,
don't.
But there's no Democratic co-sponsor, I can tell you that.
Huh.
So far. So we'll see, though. That bill is scheduled to get a vote in its committee. So we'll see how everybody votes on that. I believe that's expected at the end of the week. Another bill that was interesting, if you recall last year, the legislature put some restrictions in place for open carry. You can't do it at a permitted protest within 250 feet of a permitted protest and also on the state capitol campus. Well, there was some concern that that might have an impact on memorial services where the color guard or the honor guard are. So Representative Chris Gildon, who is a Republican, proposed a bill that would just make clear that it's okay. The color guard can have their weapons for those memorial services. But interestingly, there was some opposition voiced in those who testified, including from some veterans.
I'm concerned that further separating the rights of individual citizens versus members of law enforcement and the military negatively affects the civil relations between those groups.
I really appreciate the intent of this bill in making sure that we can give our military honors. I'm a former Marine myself and served on funeral details while I was in the Marine Corps. And I think it's really important that we are able to have these ceremonies and military duties. I'm a little confused about this because I was reading through the original bill and it seems like it's already covered under official duties for our color guards and honor guards that are military and police. And I'm wondering if there was just some confusion and not sure if we need to spend the energy that we're taking on this bill.
So there wasn't really an answer to his question. And that was really just some limited testimony on that. So we'll see if anything happens there. The big draws, though, were the two bills that would expand upon what we did for open carry restrictions last year. This proposal from Senator Patty Cooterer, it expands it to allow for local jurisdictions to limit the open carry of weapons in various places, including city or town, municipality-owned buildings, election facilities, and things like that. And it also goes around, by doing so, state preemption. So you had your usual state preemption kind of criticism. Here's some of the rest of the testimony.
The threat of armed extremism extends beyond the state capitol and public demonstrations, and the problem has only gotten worse. The share of armed protests increased in 2021, and in communities across Washington, protesters have shown up to business districts, public meetings, and residential neighborhoods armed with assault weapons to rally against coronavirus restrictions, peaceful Black Lives Matter protests, and the results of a free and fair election. And local leaders could do nothing to stop the armed intimidation.
Who would actually be targeted by this law? In my lived experience and the experiences of my friends, community over the last few years of protest, was that by and large, white protesters and open carriers would not be stopped and frisked by law enforcement, while people of color or many other less privileged groups are disproportionately targeted by law enforcement and be the ones in the end who are criminalized and harmed by this bill in long term. New victims of the prison industrial complex.
If I let you do this, what's next? And if I let you do this, who's going to come save me?
So quite a bit of people who were opposed to that bill, but it does have a lot of support, and there's a companion bill that's moving its way through the House. The biggest draw, of course, the assault weapons ban. This is a series of different military-style-looking weapons that we haven't seen this bill get a hearing, actually, in a couple of years, and this year it did. On the people on the one side, the people who were for this bill.
When assault weapons are used in mass shootings, they kill 65% more people.
Our daughter Carrie was killed in Las Vegas in the mass shooting, shot in the back with an AR-15.
As a mother, it is intolerable to me that children continue to lose lives to gun violence.
And then on the con side, you had just as many people. And as I've seen in recent years on other bills related to gun restrictions, a lot of them women who are gun owners.
The firearms listed in this bill are ones that are owned by single women, moms, and tribal women who use firearms to protect.
There are seven states and D.C. have this bill, but still have mass shootings.
Our citizens have the right and the need to be able to choose a semi-automatic rifle as their primary means of self-defense.
So that was kind of a mix of what you heard for some lengthy testimony on that bill. I also got the chance to sit in on the Democratic leadership media availability yesterday and asked both the House and Senate majority leaders what the appetite was to actually get this across the finish line this year. And both Lori Jenkins and Andy Billig said, it's early in the session, but here's some of what they said.
You know, we have a number of members who, including me, who've worked for many, many years on gun violence and gun responsibility, firearm responsibility legislation. And so we have a very strong core of people in the House who are interested in this and other bills. So I would expect to see a good dialogue in our caucus about it.
You know, you look back over the last few years and Washington has really led the way on gun safety. Proud of the steps that we've taken with bump stocks and ghost guns and creating the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. And I think we're going to always look to see if there are reasonable next steps to help keep our community safe. And it's still early in the session to know exactly what might move or not.
And that leaves open the question about the high-capacity magazines bill, which had its hearing last year. And remember, we work on a two-year legislative session cycle. So because it had its hearing last session, it was able to be pulled to what's known as second reading, which means that the Senate can pull it to the floor any time for a vote. Andy Billig was asked about that. He said he is expecting to see the ban on high-capacity magazines get pulled likely to the floor in the Senate for a vote, which would be a very big deal to see that get through the Senate and then move over to the House.
Of course, we talked about the guns and the magazines endlessly, and isn't there a consensus? The key is that these things, you're not going to be able to ban these things. It may be in Washington State temporarily, but it doesn't stick. And the key is to keep these things out of the wrong hands, like people who, of course, have criminal records, people who have mental illness, and frankly, people who have anger control problems. So what about doing something along those lines?
Well, to do that, Dave, you'd have to make sure that we have our mental health system really where it needs to be, and we don't. So there's not enough tracking. There's not enough. There's people who slip through the cracks on that. I'm sure there are efforts. Some of that falls into the federal jurisdiction as well. And it's just not good enough, that system right now. So we'll see. I will say on the high capacity magazines bill, there was a striker proposed by Senator Peterson that would change the magazine capacity. I believe it ups it to not the 10 rounds, but I believe it's 12 rounds under his bill, and it doesn't ban the possession. It just bans the manufacturer and the sale, I believe. It's a little bit different. So we'll see how that plays out if it does, in fact, get to the floor.
Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Choke Points is brought to you by Primary Residential Mortgage. You might have noticed the removal of bushes and shrubs and other vegetation near the I-5-520 interchange in Seattle. And that's because work is going on to add a reversible HOV lane between 520 and the I-5 express lanes. This is pretty exciting. So here's Chris Sullivan to explain how it's going to work.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty cool when it's up and running and should kind of help carve out a little bit faster trips for HOVs. And the first thing you notice, because I did, was I was driving back and forth through the city over the holidays, is, you know, you see how bare the east side of the freeway is right now. I mean, workers have been pulling vegetation for weeks on the west end of 520 where it meets I-5. And if you've driven around the area, too, you probably noticed there are New Jersey barriers in the middle of the freeways and some lane restrictions on I-5, the express lanes, and on those ramps from I-5 to 520.
Right now they're shifting those lanes north to create a work zone, and they'll shift them south and they'll separate them all so that they can build walls and piers for future construction.
The 520 project, Steve Pierce, says the contractor is building a new flyover ramp between the two freeways. It will run alongside the existing westbound 520 ramp to I-5, but dip down into the express lanes, creating a direct ramp to the west side of those express lanes just before Mercer.
Lots going on with that, mostly night work and mostly taking the I-5 express lanes in changing the lane configurations to be able to eventually house that HOV lane that will go between 520 and Mercer.
This is going to be a reversible HOV lane that will run west to south in the morning and then north to east in the afternoon, following the current patterns of the express lanes on I-5. It will run as a bus-only lane until the entire 520 project is completed, and then convert to an HOV lane for cars and buses after. Pierce says during the interim of construction, drivers need to be prepared for about 2 years worth of moving lanes and lane configurations.
Some of the lanes will be a little thinner than what they used to be, so drivers should be careful through that area, but ultimately they'll rebuild those two ramps to better configure with this new flyover and the future Portage Bay Bridge and Roanoke Lid project.
Pierre expects this reversible lane project to be done about the same time as the work on the Montlake Lid. Current schedule shows late 2023 for both of those projects wrapping up. But, of course, this is not the end of the construction on the 520 corridor, as I keep reminding you. We still have about 9 years of work left to endure. That time, of course, will be needed to build the new bridges over Portage Bay and create that new lid over Roanoke there right at the I-5 interchange.
Now, I drive it so many times that I have trouble visualizing when I think of it. So are these express lanes, the express lanes are at the lower level at this point, right?
That is correct. So just imagine you have the two, you have the I-5 lane that, or sorry, 520 that veers off to the left and goes down and joins I-5 on the left-hand side of the main line, right?
Right.
As you're going west off of I-5 or 520, you peel down to the left. This new express lane or express HOV lane is going to be a ramp right next to that where, and then it's going to dip down to the next level at the same spot where the other one joins I-5 mainline. So yeah, they're going to be parallel, but one's going to dip down a little further.
So like a little roller coaster there.
Kind of. Yeah. But it won't be too severe, but then, yeah, that's why they're moving the lane a little bit to the north so they can
fit
that
no,
in there.
But then there's no, and then it'll connect to a new carpool lane to be built across Portage Bay?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Eventually there are going to be three lanes coming out of there, just like there is the whole way across the lake right now.
And okay. I see. Cause I was wondering what would you connect it to?
Right. So eventually they're going to be the two lanes and an HOV lane going all the way across the lake, all the way to I-5, eventually. That's what it's going to take that next 9 years as they build that Portage Bay interchange and the new lid over Roanoke.
Wait, so, you said 9 years?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Nine years for the whole rest of the West. This HOV lane is going to be open in about 2 years for buses. It's going to be there. Then they're going to build the new lid over Roanoke and I-5 there to accommodate this new flyover ramp, which will already then be in existence. So it's 9 years before the entire 520 project is done, but this little part of it, that reversible lane, will be done in 2 years.
And this is
and
all
operational.
Now, this is all paid for as part of the
oh, yeah. Yeah.
The money is already there.
Yeah, this has been funded by the legislature. What they're still trying to do is final configuration on what Portage Bay is going to look like and all of the work there. And I think they might need a little more money for that, but it's scheduled. And the legislature's already put it on the schedule. So,
and when they say they're going to be changing the width of the lanes, that always concerns me because I frankly think a lot of them are too narrow right now. So How narrow are we talking here?
Well, probably down to, you know, the minimum you go is about 10 and a half feet. They'll probably go from 12 to 11, probably.
Okay,
just, and again, this
bad.
Is interim. This is interim. By the, when the lid is all done, they'll be back to full size, full width.
Oh,
but
I see.
This is okay. Kind of like a construction transition, kind of like, just imagine the people who live in the Roanoke neighborhood at 520 in Montlake are going to be enduring a little bit more of what Tacoma's had for the last 25 years, which is
another
lane,
Puyallup
fattening,
Bridge project.
Widening, fattening, widening, moving left, right, yeah.
By the way, when will that be done?
This spring. This spring. Remember over the winter we got the bad news that they had those supply chain issues. The rain came in early.
Yeah.
So they're expecting that full project to be done middle of the year, middle to late. So hopefully before the fall. That
but
project.
So this spring, the construction in Tacoma is finished?
Yeah. Yeah, for that project, for that, exactly. Both Puyallup River bridges will be open. The HOV lane system will be working. What they will start doing then is doing more of the work for the Gateway project, which is tying in 167 over the top of I-5 there to go to Port of Tacoma. And then, of course, they're going to keep working a little bit further south of JBLM to keep widening that HOV lane system there down through DuPont.
How about that, Tacomans? And you thought you'd never live to see the day. And you just might. It's...
Yeah, that's,
In Olympia, we're 2 weeks into the short 60-day legislative session. Things are moving quickly, and immersed in the session is Cairo News Radio's Hannah Scott, who has an update on the long-term care tax delay and some other highlights. Hi, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, I know everybody is wondering what's going to happen with this long-term care tax delay bill. There's actually another bill that would allow for some further exemptions, some voluntary exemptions for folks to opt out of this tax. Both of those had hearings very quickly, and then not much has happened since then. Yesterday, House Speaker Lori Jenkins was asked what would be coming next, as both bills are sitting in the House at the moment, and here's what she had to say.
We're expecting this Wednesday that we will move a couple bills related to the CARES Act off of the House floor. They had great bipartisan support out of the Appropriations Committee.
And from there, they'll pop on over to the Senate, where Majority Leader Andy Billig says,
our plan is to move the bill through committee and off the floor all next week. And our goal will be to pass it late next week.
Now, there he's speaking specifically about the delay, so it sounds like that could be done and on the governor's desk in under 2 weeks, which I know he is expected to sign. We'll see about that opt-out bill. It does have bipartisan support and is likely to also pass the Senate.
Mm-hmm. And before you move on, so this basically means that nobody has to worry about their pay being docked because of this tax.
That is still up to the individual employer at the moment until they pass this bill. So once it's passed, that's and the governor signs it and it takes effect, then yes, you don't have to worry about that. But the law already took effect, so there could be some employers out there taking that tax out of your check currently, and I think many of them actually are.
But then they would refund it, right?
You'll be refunded as soon as the governor signs the bill. That refund will come to you, and that will be that. Speaking of the governor, the other interesting, and I know you did something on this a little yesterday, but I wanted to share some of the feedback I had gotten. The governor, you know, we'd heard him talking quite a bit about the issue of lying for elected officials,
yes,
about election results and all of that. There hadn't been a bill. He had said he thought it should be outlawed, right? So there was no bill, though, after he had said it a couple of times. Last week, I got a chance to ask Republican leadership about it. This is what Senate Majority Leader John Braun and House Minority Leader J.T. Wilcox said to me last week when I asked about it.
I think it should be clear that lying's a bad idea. We should not do that. We should just tell the truth. And it's not clear to me you can legislate that, frankly. And I'm not sure, you know, constitutionally you can do that.
I've seen, I think, quite a bit of skepticism. This is a trap of being a politician. You think that you can fix everything by passing a law. Things aren't that easy to fix.
So yesterday I got a chance to ask Senate Majority Leader Andy Billig about the support for this bill after it dropped, because both he and the House Speaker had said something similar. They weren't really sure about the constitutionality of such an idea early in session. And here's what Billig said yesterday.
I'll just say, you know, I share the governor's outrage at these, you know, absurd lies that have been perpetrated, completely debunked. And they incite violence. They incite mistrust. So I share his outrage about those. But whether you can actually regulate that or not. I'm not sure. I think I'd really want to dive into the legalities of it before I venture support one way or the other for that specific bill.
Now, at last check, that bill did not have a hearing. I will say I reached out to the senator who is listed as the sponsor of that bill yesterday to see about getting an interview, and I got a text back simply saying, this is the governor's bill.
Don't want to talk about it. I saw it had several sponsors. I mean, there's text there.
Yeah.
So, but it sounds like it's not going to get a hearing.
And there is, I mean, it does cite, I don't know if you read the bill, it does cite a prior, I believe, a U.S. Supreme Court decision. So, but yeah, I'm getting the same from no matter which side I talk to.
Imminent, what is it? Imminent action.
Yeah.
Imminent violence. Which is a
imminent
Supreme
violence.
Court
system, yes. Right. So, yeah, so exactly. We'll see. It's just one of those things. There's a couple of things coming up before I get to my final story that I want to get to that we're going to be watching today. The zoning bills that I think I've talked to you about before that are the governor request zoning bills to basically take away the local control and allow for your duplexes, your triplexes, your quads in just about every single family zoned residence area across the state. Mm-hmm. Those are going to get hearings today, so that will be a big deal. We also expect tomorrow to see a massive day about legal cannabis, legal weed. So it's 10 years since the passage.
Well, this is about setting up banks for legal weed, right?
We've got banks. We've got the idea of changing the makeup of the Liquor Control Board as it relates to marijuana handling, and then also equity in marijuana licensing, because there's been, you know, we've talked about this before. Disproportionately,
right.
Black people were sent to prison, and many of them after legalization.
For doing what is now legal.
For doing what's now legal. But they didn't get any of the licenses. They're not getting any of the benefits. So there's that effort underway and really a big overhaul, the first big update to the entire system. So I'll keep you updated on that.
Okay. And one more thing I want to ask you about on this whole zoning thing. I got a note from a listener saying, look, if you want to really reduce the price of housing, open up some of that land that's been taken off limits to development. And so there's nothing in this bill that would do that?
Not this particular bill, but there is a massive couple of housing bills. There's growth management bills going on. And in fact,
so they might change the Growth Management Act to open up some of that land?
Yes, absolutely. And remember, right now, without getting into too much of the you know, minutia, there's the comprehensive plan is what local jurisdictions are working on right now. Mm-hmm. That is a, I believe, once a decade plan they have to come up with to get to the point where you change the Growth Management Act. So we're in the final stages of that. I believe 2023 is when that's due. And so you'll see a lot of proposals in that area, and I'll be sure and have an update for you after. There's a growth management hearing today that I'll be watching, so I'll get more on that for you.
Right. Very good.
Another bill is a safety bill. This is not one, this doesn't necessarily grab all the big headlines. It has to do with an effort for a proposal called Zach's Law. It is proposed from some parents whose son died in Chelan County recently after jumping in the water and suffering from cold water shock. The proposal would basically be for signs to be put up warning in popular swimming areas where this can happen. For people who don't know, cold water shock is what happens when, you know, it might be 70 degrees outside here and you jump in the water and it's you know, just 50 degrees and people suffer some very severe health issues and often drown, especially teenagers. Ahead of the bill, we had concerns from Robert Sutherland, who thought it might open us up to some legal issues.
You know, there's a million hazards out there for when people go out. You know, I don't know that it's the state's responsibility to say, listen, hiking on this trail, you might trip, you might fall, you might break an ankle. Has there been any consideration to the fact that if we put signs up here and there, but not here and there, the state might be liable for lawsuits against it for not warning the public? So if we're going to start warning, now we run the risk of saying, you know, someone saying that, well, listen, there's signs all over the place, but there's none here, so I thought it was safe.
Then the Zach's mother testified.
And of course, everybody knows the effects of cold water, but not everybody knows the cold water shock. I myself have never heard of cold water shock until my son passed away. This is an important subject that I think should be... It's important so that everybody can know about the dangers of cold water shock and cold water drownings. Had myself or Zachary known about the risks that happened during cold water shock, my son would still be with me today.
She went on to say that if even one person is saved by these signs, that her son would not have died in vain. That caused Representative Sutherland to recall his own experience like this as a child.
And everything that was described happened to me. And I didn't, I'm uneducated on cold water shock. So you've educated me, and I want to thank you for that. I survived, obviously. But it was a traumatic experience. You can't breathe. You gasp for air. And you're in trouble. Fortunately, I didn't go under. And I believe that's probably why I'm here. So thank you for your testimony and for educating people like me. And I just want to let you know, for what it's worth, that based on your testimony, you now have my support.
It was a very emotional hearing, and she really did seem to move most of the room. So I would expect to see more movement on that bill.
Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
I always try not to cackle at the end of your commentaries, but often that last line always makes me go, ha! Good one, Dave.
I didn't hear it.
And which daughter? You didn't name her.
No, I keep that confident.
Oh, okay. All right. I was going to say, good job, so-and-so, but we'll keep it a secret. Your daily dose of kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. It was a nightmare scenario turned into a miracle-like rescue in Colorado this month. Four children playing on a frozen pond when, yeah.
I was just looking out my window and saw a couple kids just walking on the ice pond.
That's 23-year-old Dusty Talavera, who lives in an apartment complex nearby and who turned into a hero, nearly sacrificing herself.
Before I even realized it, I was out there on the middle of the pond pulling two kids out, and that's when I fell in the pond.
Then
there was a young man that threw us a rope, and he pulled us out.
A second hero. Two of the kids did make it out safely, unharmed. However, once Dusty was able to bring up a 6-year-old to the surface and onto the sidewalk, that child wasn't breathing. Deputy Blaine Moulton with the and Deputy Justin Dillard tells our CBS Denver affiliate KCNC-TV everyone worked to revive that child.
Seeing her her breathe before being transported to, I think you guys ended up going to Children's Hospital, was a massive relief.
Honestly, I would say it was just a perfect storm, to be honest. The fact that we had her witness these kids fall in there and her quick reaction to just quickly put on some shoes and run out there.
And crews were thankful Dusty showed such immense bravery.
We were back at the fire station talking about how brave she was, how great the officers did. And gosh, I hope if this happened to one of mine that somebody like her was close by.
Always good to be looking out.
Oh, that's scary. Mm-hmm. That's very scary. 7:46 and direct from the Gio and Ursula show. It starts at 9. Here is G. Scott. Did you see the figures on the test scores? First, I should ask, are you somebody who believes in testing or not?
No.
You don't.
I don't.
Thank you.
I've been saying get rid of them for years, but it always kind of felt like nobody would really listen to me because, no, we need that. We need that. It reminds me of when the crack epidemic was here, right? And they would just say, no, this is not a problem. You just got to lock everybody up. But now, today, it's a broader problem. And, oh, we really have a drug crisis. We really have to get to the bottom of that because kids in the suburbs are being impacted about what's going on. Here we are with testing. Go ahead and tell me what you got to tell me about testing, Dave.
Well, the latest figures, we're trying to assess the impact of the pandemic on education. Mm-hmm. And we find now that on the math portion of the standard exam, the overall average has gone down 20 percentage points. So only 30% of kids are considered proficient in math, grades 4 through 11. And, of course,
you know
when you get to kids who are poor, it's down to 16%.
Because that's the last thing they're worried about when they're trying to survive a pandemic. When their parents are stressed out, when their parents are scared, when they're scared, when they're getting vaccinated. Like, don't talk to me about test numbers in kids right now. Talk to me about their mental health. Talk to me about their education around physical health. Like, I don't have any patience for this kind of topic.
It's almost like you mean some of those kids they got to worry about, like, even before the pandemic, they'd come home, they're having
where
to worry about food, where
yeah.
the food's coming from, if mom or dad is in jail and all those things. But yeah, they're supposed to score high so they can go to college. Let me simplify it.
So the school can get funding is what it is.
Oh, no doubt about it. Oh, those test scores.
We're so worried.
These tests are not a proper way to measure intelligence and comprehension. The only thing that these tests determine is simple, that the students are good at taking tests. Mm-hmm. When you pay for these services, by the way, I was fortunate enough to be able to afford to pay for my kids to take some of these classes to be able to be bettered on these SAT and or ACT tests. What you learn, you don't learn any new knowledge. You just learn how to take a test. That's it. You learn how to take a test. And so these tests, they find out who's good at taking tests. They offer no meaningful measure of progress and have not improved student performance. Like, for example, when my kids went to go take these classes to prepare for these tests, that didn't make them better at school. It only made them better at tests. So, Dave, Colleen, this is something that I have always been against. It's another barrier to prevent so many in this country the opportunity for being able to go to college or get into that college. And so I've never liked it. And I'm not glad that kids are going through this right now, because truth be told, I believe that right now for kids going to school during a pandemic, like, guys, really? What, you really got school in your mind?
This opens a whole new topic. This opens a whole new topic then. So do you believe in grades?
Oh, now we're talking. I believe in pass or fail.
Pass or fail.
I believe in pass or fail. I don't believe.
So we really shouldn't keep records then, careful records on who's doing well and who's not and which subjects they're weakest in, huh?
You can, but I'll tell you the reasons why I am kind of against the grades, right? And I'm not against them because, I mean, I did okay in school. So that's not the point. My point is I have seen some kids, they get a stigma, right? Mm-hmm. And so they've gone to school, they've worked there. Let's say that English class, they are working really hard and trying to do the best that they can, and they just can't get it. And all of a sudden, they get a D, even though they worked hard for it. That even though they're proficient in every other topic, everything, they're a good person. They have good. They do everything right. They're a good person, a good citizen. They do well in math. They do well in all of these classes. But it's that D that makes them spiral.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But then, well, that would make teaching easier, because then basically the teacher would teach and the kids either learn it or they don't.
Well, no, I think it would make, before Dave pins you up against the wall, I want to interject, because he said, well, then we shouldn't keep careful records of testing scores. As somebody who grew up in the public school system around here, as somebody who has a child in the public school system now, I will say this. They take tests all the time. I never see the results of those tests, so I can advocate for my child and say, hey, they seem to be struggling in this area. Can we put more focus on the kids because of that? I never see the results of the tests actually show up in the classroom where they go, oh, this student is proficient at this. We should move them into a pod of students.
Really?
Who are
then
also
what's
proficient.
The point of the test? I mean, I brought home all my tests and my parents, I mean, that was the whole thing. Report
these
card
states,
day.
These state
the
standardized tests, I never see the results of those. I barely see she just took an advanced placement test. Uh-huh. I have no idea what she did, how it's being applied, how it's being used by her teacher to better educate her. So, to me, tests are only a measure of can you get funding or can you not? I would love to debate a teacher on this, or anybody, because I want to know more.
Well, first of all, I 100% believe in education. I believe in kids going to school. I also believe, this is why I'm always praising teachers, right? I 100% believe in their efforts, and what they do in the classroom is appreciated. Anybody that takes our children for 7 hours a day is an amazing person in administration in itself. I think our problem is that we are all set in our ways. And so the decision makers are still, well, back in my day, are still on those things, and we're not trying to progress forward and further. So let's just go back to the test. Get rid of them. Just get rid of the test. This barrier, the only thing it says is that you're good at testing. It does not say what type of person or what type of student that you're going to be. I know that there are a lot of people that are successful today in business and might have had a 2.2 grade point average when they were in school.
2.9 right here, baby.
You see what I'm saying? Or but then you have the person that, oh, I had a 3.7. So how'd that, so what does that mean? Right? Grades are subjective. And I don't want to go deeper into that topic of grades because I think that's a longer conversation. So I'll just stay with the test. Get rid of the test. Get rid of the test. I'm going to throw this in. You ready? The same way you get rid of credit scores to determine your premium for your driver's insurance. Mm. How about that?
Well, it's too bad we're out of time because I have many things to say. But
we can continue this.
That'll have to wait. It is 7:54. G and Ursula starting at 9 o'clock on Cairo Radio. And Tuesday mornings, we go live to Washington, D.C., and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold. I think let's start with this new voting rights bill. I didn't realize that they actually rewrote it. They combined the previous two voting rights bills and then rewrote them, and they're going to put them to a vote in the Senate. They know it's not going to pass. And since they know it's not going to pass, why go through all the trouble of rewriting and putting it up for a vote?
Well, I think they were hoping that the original version passed in the House was, I think, seen by everyone as impossible to pass in the Senate. So I think there's two purposes here. One, they know that if they're ever going to get Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, the two Democratic roadblocks to this, to sign on, they're going to have to rewrite it. So they're starting down that path. But also, there's this thing that happens in Congress, and I saw it when I was a congressional reporter, where you think in Congress that the world is watching you. And so you think it's important to take votes that you'll know you'll lose just to show people, you know, that the Republicans are in this case are standing in the way of progress. Truthfully, no one cares. No one's really watching this. And it really what the message they're going to take away is that it's Democrats blocking this, not Republicans, because those are the votes that actually seem gettable and are not.
So you think this is a mistake?
I do. I don't think there's any point in the Senate taking votes that they know they're going to lose. I think that often happens in Congress, and people think that someone's watching, but really no one's watching this. No one wants to watch a vote that's not going to change anything.
Yeah, right. It seems to be what they think they're going to do is create a lot of video they can use for campaign ads, right, of certain people voting against voting and apple pie, right? So they put all the key stuff into this bill, like mail-in voting and more early voting, and then they can say, well, so-and-so, did you know that in 2022 so-and-so voted against this?
That's possible. I don't think that's going to matter a huge amount for the Senate races that are coming up in the fall. I just don't think there's any – like that would matter if you had a moderate Republican running in a blue state and you were trying to show Democratic voters, hey, look, don't cross over for this person. I don't think that's really a big deal in the elections that are coming up this fall. So I don't think it will even matter in that context.
I wanted to ask you about Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida. Apparently there has been a falling out between him and Donald Trump, and – I see speculation that he is trying essentially to moderate his image or distance himself from Trump so he can run as the Trump alternative in the Republican primaries. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I think DeSantis does want to run for president, but I don't think he's figured out how he's going to do it if Trump also runs. So, you know, DeSantis made his bones in Florida running as Trump's guy. He was originally not very well known. He was not the front runner in that Republican primary to run for governor, but then he just really went all in for Trump. He made a campaign ad where his kids were building the wall. They were building like a wall in his house. So like that's been his thing all along. And even now he's gone so far in, you know, on COVID and on voting rights and embracing Trump's point of view. He just said yesterday, I think, that he wants to create a new police force in Florida to arrest people who violate voting laws. Again, this a problem doesn't exist. So I think that his plan all along had been to be the person who would pick up the Trump mantle if Trump didn't pick it up himself. If Trump does run, I think it's going to be really hard for DeSantis to find a set of people who like him and not Trump.
I missed Trump's Arizona speech. Did he break any new ground?
No. It's a lot of the same thing you heard before. I mean, when was the last time Donald Trump broke new ground?
Well, I mean, were there big crowds there? I mean, did the act still work?
I mean, the act works for the crowds that shows up. I think it was a good crowd. But, you know, it's, you know, lies about the election, attacks on Biden. You know, there has not been new material. Trump has not debuted new material in quite a while.
Okay, and the in terms of the amount of money he's raised, as I've mentioned before, I for some reason, well, I know why I'm on his phone list because we covered him in New Hampshire in 2016, and so they sent me these text messages. Has he raised substantial amounts of money for his various PACs?
Huge amounts of money. I get the same text too because of events I went to back in 2016. I think last we checked, which has been several months, he had more than $100 million in his PAC, and he basically spent none of it. So that would be money that he could use for a new presidential campaign if he started one. But there's so few limits on this spending from those PACs. He could pay it to himself. He could do almost anything with that money. And yes, he keeps raising it relentlessly. I get five or six texts a day saying, like, mm-hmm. You didn't respond to our text from 5 minutes ago. Where's your money?
Yeah, exactly. Well, now you won your Pulitzer tracking the way he spends his money. Do you know how he's spending this?
His PAC money, I think. We don't know a huge amount because it's only required to report, I think, twice a year. Mm-hmm. So we don't get updates other than we haven't gotten an update in months. But the last I saw, he really wasn't spending it. I mean, he was not spending it to support other candidates. He mm-hmm. was spending a little bit to raise money, but he's not spending it on any real political activity. He's paying some of it to his businesses, mm-hmm. And he's spending some on lawyers' fees. But mostly,
oh, that's what I was wondering. Okay, so in other words, because I know that his critics are saying, well, he's just raising this because he needs a way to pay all the lawyers for the various lawsuits against him. But you're saying it's not a substantial amount on lawyers.
Well, there's some on lawyers, but he got the Republican National Committee to pay his legal bills. They're paying his legal bills in their New York Attorney General's investigation of his business.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which has nothing to do with his time as president. It all has to do with things that happened before he was a candidate. And remember, Trump's not a candidate now. He's just a guy.
Right. Well, but I'm a little surprised by that because I figure the people who give directly to Trump are the true believers, and they wouldn't mind if he spent the money on legal fees to protect himself. They'd probably be cool with that. But people who are giving money to the Republican Party in general or other candidates, you mean a substantial amount of that goes to Trump's legal fees?
At least $1.6 million and probably more. Yes, that's right. They're paying Trump's private legal fees and an investigation that has nothing to do with his political career. Just because I think they want Trump on their good side. They rely on Trump as a fundraiser. And so there's no like sort of legal reason they have to. They're just doing it basically to keep him in his good graces.
Yeah. Okay. Well, on those Trump lawsuits, any new developments in any of those? And which one do you think is the most serious one that is there a serious lawsuit that could affect his decision to run again?
It's hard to know. I mean, the last part, it's hard to know what would affect his decision to run or not. I mean, he may decide he loves being an ex-president more than he liked being the president. but there's an investigation in Georgia into his alleged interference in the 2020 election there, which we heard about when it was launched about a year ago. But we haven't heard anything about since. So that could be serious. That obviously is a very serious offense, but nobody's been charged with anything there. In New York, there is a civil investigation and a criminal investigation into his business. But those, I thought maybe we would have answers on those in the first couple months of this year. But now the New York Attorney General has signaled there's a big fight in the courts about whether Don Jr., Ivanka, and Trump Sr. can be deposed by the New York Attorney General. The timeline of the New York courts means we're not going to even get to them getting interviewed for another few months. Mm-hmm. I would have to think that any charges or lawsuit would be filed after that.
And we still don't have his tax returns.
We still don't have his tax returns. I think we're getting perhaps closer to that, but no, we don't have them.
By the way, I don't know if you saw the Edelman Trust Barometer, which measures global trust in governments and media. And the 2022 report shows that it's very bad, especially for media. I believe it's down to something like 30. I wish I had the exact number. 36%. And people actually trust businesses more. So as a member of the media and at a pretty high level, being that you worked for The Washington Post and you're headed for The New York Times, what would you suggest that your bosses do to raise trust in mainstream media?
Well, I think there's two things at work here. One is that the media includes a bunch of other people who are not trying to get it right. Partisan news outlets, people who are just trying to get clicks. You know, there's a whole world about people out there who are, don't care if the public doesn't trust them. They just want their audience to click. For us, people who want people's trust and work to earn people's trust, the thing that I think we can do a little bit better is to show people more about how we know what we know, what we do to try to get the information we find, and be more forthcoming when we get things wrong. I'm starting the New York Times next week. That's the one thing I'm going to try to do in my reporting is to show people, look, here's what I'm trying to find out. Here's how I know what I know, you know, and to let people sort of into that process more so they see how hard we work to get it right.
The actual percentage is 43%. I just found it. Trust in traditional media, 43% in the U.S. The Chinese trust their media more than Americans trust their media.
How many choices do they have?
Exactly. Exactly. David Farenthold, soon to be with the New York Times. David, thank you very much. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.